everyone is using solar power. And look, in the most unusual places, you're going to find people using alternative energy. Even if it is drug dealers and a drug cartel that's using solar power, at least someone is. And I don't know if you saw this, but there's evidently a big tunnel between the U.S. and Mexico where they had, you know, rail service, and they had a everything was done with solar power, you know, underground, you know, going to really help with the wall. The wall is going to do wonders in stopping the solar powered rail line underneath it. Yeah, there you go. But hey, good on them. At least they're thinking about being, you know, about climate change, being energy independent. You know, good on them. Let's find out what's going on around the world. And in New York City, Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
You're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
So at least somebody's using solar power, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you got to hand it to drug cartels. They're always, you know, they probably, well, except for when they, you know, like leave a bunch of plastic waste and chemical runoff in the forest. But otherwise, you know, they're living off the grid.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, I mean, they're teaching us how to be self-sufficient. Maybe we could learn a thing or two from the drug cartel.
Oh boy,
that went south.
You
really
walked back those comments almost as they were coming out of my mouth.
really quickly. Let's move along. Evidently, the death penalty. Some good news on the death penalty front. Are we going to be killing more people? Yes or no?
Not in the state of Washington, nor in the nation of Malaysia. Let's start with Washington. Now, the 20th state plus the district plus Puerto Rico to abolish what I believe to be an abhorrent practice. I didn't used to always feel that way. I mean, I really, I don't know. I grew up in Massachusetts at a time when we had Republican governors in the 90s and Paul Salucci and all these other guys. And they, you know, they kind of won me over with some kind of basic but emotionally resonant logic. Right, yeah, the retribution, you know, and
deterrent.
The data has not only come into crush that there's no real sort of benefit, there's no deterrent effect here, but the evidence, as at least presented in this to the Washington Supreme Court and what they ruled on today, overwhelmingly showing that when you take the implicit and overt racial bias against black defendants, even in that state, which are the court's own words, and add to it their determination based on studies that, quote, the association between race and the death penalty is not attributed to random chance, end quote. I don't think you can deny, have a separate conclusion than the one that they came to. The defendant in this case, someone who had been accused of aggravated first degree murder, commissioned an academic survey of the way death penalty was applied in that state. And in this survey, it alleged that black defendants were 4.5 times more likely to be sentenced to death. You know, again, I think it's a great decision. Apparently, Georgia, according to the court, has almost an identical law and has identical requirements for the courts to consider when someone is on death row. And yet in Georgia, the death penalty is still active. So anyone in Georgia, you are now armed with a Supreme Court ruling from Washington that I think in a very, very compelling way refutes many of the main remaining arguments for the death penalty. I would love to see some progress in that state. Thing is, looking at the recent trajectory, at least since 2007, you have seen a number of states abolish the death penalty. I'll name them for you: New Jersey, New York, New Mexico, Illinois, Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware, Washington. I see a trend there. This is still an issue that breaks down along party lines. Blue states are abolishing this practice. Red states are not. And I think that it's too bad this has become a partisan issue. I'm guessing, actually, maybe at the polling level, it's not quite as black and white. But it is pretty astonishing to see sort of how the countries break or the states break down.
Well, for me, it comes down to a couple of things, because I have a number of acquaintances that I know that they're highly religious. So this breaks down to the old school fire and brimstone, eye for an eye. For them, you know, then this is God's will, and if you take a life, we take your life. For them, that it's that simple. And for, you know, some of the folks on the left, the argument that you made that it's heavily racially biased, you know, poor inner city youth, you don't generally stand a chance because they don't get good representation, especially at the initial level. And you know, look, it, there's just so many people, you know, of minority status in the system, you know, because they've been in some cases railroaded, in some cases, you know, properly convicted, but they don't have the resources to fight and as wealthier classes do, and they end up being the ones who get the brunt of it.
Exactly. And skipping overseas to Malaysia, a country of 30-odd million people, which has now banned this practice, or at least has, you know, put it on pause as the lawmakers next week pick up bills to ban it. But I think it's pretty much a done deal at this point. 1,200 death row inmates are going to be spared hanging, which is a tremendous victory, I think, for that country's criminal justice system. Turns out it was the story of one death row inmate, this 29-year-old father, who had been jailed and sentenced to death for selling cannabis oil to medicinal patients, really appears to have been the sort of emotional story that had a profound effect in changing that country's laws. And that's a pretty big turnaround, a country that really, you know, had used that, you know, very strong sort of deterrent or thinking to try and dissuade people from drug crimes, finding, no, actually, it's A, not having an effect in that domain, and is just unjust. It's interesting, too, Malaysia is a country that has a number of its citizens overseas sentenced to death and has been trying to get them those sentences, you know, dismissed. I think they found, hey, it's pretty hard to preach to your neighboring countries that they shouldn't kill your citizens if you're doing it to your own. And that brings us to a good point. I mean, this is a part of a world, you know, 142 countries now ban the death penalty. We had a lot of these countries in Southeast Asia. It's still policy, including in a place like Singapore, which, you know, we think, oh, it's like such a great modern place. Well, they're quite barbaric when it comes to that kind of, you know, criminal punishment.
Crime.
And, of course, we
can still
talk
cane
about
people,
the Philippines.
Right? They still cane people, right?
Famously, I'm sure it still happens. It's, I doubt it's as prevalent as, you know, historical examples might suggest. But yeah, I mean, and think you've got the Philippines not too far away where extrajudicial killings and the death penalty are, you know, bragged about by their president. Yeah. So that's a, you know, we'd love to see some more global progress here.
But
too.
on the Malaysia death penalty thing, it's kind of like siblings. You know, we can beat, you can beat your siblings up, but just don't let somebody else beat them up. So it's
exactly.
Okay if we kill them, but you, no, not you.
Well, I think it's good now that the overwhelming majority of countries have blocked this process, because it starts to make the old countries clinging to some, you know, outdated status quo look like the odd ones out. And so I hope that continues to race us towards a global abolition here. It really is an issue where I had, you know, fights with, kind of funny, I remember having like one of the most heated fights of my life with my high school girlfriend over the death penalty. And it was like one of my last stands on that issue where I really gave it my all. It was kind of a devil's advocate argument, and I really just tried to summon all of the, you know, things I'd heard, and I kind of walked away from that being like, what the heck am I doing? Like, who did, you know, I was maybe being the devil's advocate there, but I had to believe some of that stuff, and I kind of took a step back and have not looked back on that issue, and I refuse to be, you know, told, hey, you're a journalist, you shouldn't be have opinions. This is one issue where I just am completely comfortable speaking out against the death penalty. I just do not think in our, you know, our failings as humans and our prejudices just make it impossible to be able to use this as a tool where prejudice doesn't play a major role in who we decide to kill.
Yeah. So the big question is, you know, the girl who handed you your head, you still talk to her?
No, not for that reason, but it probably didn't help. It certainly drove us apart.
There you go. See, I'm not totally opposed to the death penalty. And I think, you know, bankers and Wall Street criminals, you know, who crash our economy and, you know, steal thousands of people's homes or millions of people's homes and steal the, you know, the savings of millions of people. You know, I'm almost okay with that. I would almost be okay with public executions there. In fact, I would have liked to have seen it in 2009. I know that that's not the right PC thing to say, but still, these criminals, something, there's got to be something, because they care if they live or die. Just my thought. Evidently, the U.S. is accusing a Chinese spy of espionage. Tell me about it.
Yeah, he was arrested in April in Belgium and extradited to the U.S. this week. Evidently, American authorities needed to find a way to get this guy out of China, so they made up some ruse where, you know, he was going to rendezvous with someone in Belgium and we must have worked this out with the Belgian authorities, and they snatched him, or we snatched him, and now he's, or I guess they did, and now he's back in American custody. Evidently, this one man, since 2013, engaged in economic espionage and attempts to steal trade secrets from the United States. The victims here are targets, General Electric Aviation Division, and perhaps Boeing, the DOJ being a little bit coy about which companies exactly were targeted here, but it sounds like Boeing was maybe a target. This does seem to be a trend. I mean, you know, I think a lot of foreign companies are wising up to the extent to which it's just not safe to bring a laptop or a phone into China and expect any of the information on those devices to be held safe. And for many years, that was an incredibly efficient way for the Chinese government to just sort of lift, you know,
you could say
corporate
steal.
I'm talking more about the mechanism through which it is, you know, actually physically taken or digitally taken off the device, you know, using RFID systems and other sorts of almost like magnetically lifting the data out of the phones when you go through a scanner at the airport. But it is theft, of course. But I think companies are wising up. Companies are also basically starting to be more hesitant when it comes to signing deals with the Chinese government that force them to hand over tons of intellectual property in the process. And now they have extra urgency in China to figure out a way to keep getting all that info. They have this made in China strategy for the next few years where the goal is, hey, let's build up our domestic sectors like, you know, biotech and defense and transport and things like and aerospace. And, you know, if they're not getting the info through other more sort of passive means, or, you know, the info isn't walking into their door through their door, then they've, you know, they're doing sorts of intrusion efforts like this. So it's an interesting case. I'm very curious to learn more. I'm sure the DOJ will be a little bit quiet on exactly all the means used here by this individual to try and get this information. But suffice it to say, we have seen this White House really ramp up attacks on China. And I have to say, I think it's kind of the round two of the trade war, right? And it may have something to do with the midterms, right? I am a little skeptical about some of the ways in which these, you know, electoral interference claims are being batted around in the run-up to what could be kind of a trouncing for Republican candidates. It would be nice if the White House could say, hey, you know, Republicans are still popular. The reason they didn't win in November is because, you know, the Chinese had electoral interference in the Midwest. So I'm a little bit wary of this, but this, I have to imagine, is this kind of espionage is also occurring. And I am tempted not to read too much, you know, political, you know, stuff into this decision to announce this conviction. But it shows you probably how big the problem is.
No, I've been saying it for years, and this is the one thing where I'm almost with the administration, you know, in going after China. I mean, you know, I've heard horror stories for years of U.S. companies going over there and having their products, you know, having their R&D stolen, having their projects retro-engineered, having, you know, people stealing their technology. And at some point, somebody has to do something. And look, I am not a big supporter of Trump by any stretch of the imagination. But at some point, you got to stop the guy from eating your lunch. Because it's never gonna stop until you put your foot down. At least that's just my view on it.
Yep. No, I agree. And my guess is, if this administration is going full bore towards this in another political environment, I'm sure these people could be, let's say, denied a visa once we discover that they're engaged in this. But we might sort of make a political calculus and say, all right, we're trying to work towards a deal. We're trying to get China's cooperation on sanctions on North Korea. Let's keep this guy in pretrial hearings or not make a huge deal out of this, or maybe just ban him from coming to the United States. The political climate has shifted so much, and I think the administration is throwing everything at China that they've got, and there's probably still tons more to come, and, you know, sort of trying to use it as leverage in the trade war. I'm with you on a lot of what you just said, and I think more of it is going to come.
No, I'm all in favor of it, and I have a lot of friends who are saying, you know, the tariffs are causing a trade war, and it's hurting Ford, and it's hurting... I go, you know, but here's the reality. The reality is if you do nothing, it all goes away. Because, you know, their China 2020 plan they've got is targeting Boeing. Their plan is targeting Apple. Their plan is targeting, you know, the next generation of technology. And, right. You know, they're not the ones developing it. They're stealing it. And at some point, you have to say we have to stop it. And look what they've done with you name the product that we used to buy. When I was a kid, every single toy I had in my toy box was made somewhere here in the U.S. Find a U.S.-made toy. Good luck on that. Tools used to all be made in the U.S. Good luck finding tools made in the U.S. You can go down the list of all the things that we used to make for ourselves that used to at least you had the option of buying. They're all gone. All of it's gone. And, you know, the last bit of frontier we've got left is technology and you know, aerospace and, you know, some of this other stuff. And they're going after that. And at some point, you've got to say, you know, when do you finally put your foot down? And as I said, not a Trump supporter by any stretch of the imagination. But at least this, the blind squirrel found a nut. Just my view again. Saudi Arabia, what do we know? Anything new? Anything new on the journalist that was... I'm guessing, you know, chopped up and taken out the back door, anything?
There are some media reports. I can't really independently assess them that give some rather violent details of how Mr. Khashoggi may have met an end at that embassy or consulate a little over a week ago. Let's put those on the back burner and just talk a little bit about what President Trump has said about this case. He was pressed today in the Oval Office. You know, is the U.S. going to rethink the U.S. Saudi Arabia relationship in light of what probably is a really astonishing, grievous attack on Mr. Khashoggi. Here's President Trump's quote. Let me read it to you, and then I'll pick apart three bits of it. Here's the quote. This took place in Turkey, and to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a U.S. citizen. Is that right? He turns to ask journalists. As to whether we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, that would not be acceptable to me, end quote. First off, this man is clearly looking for excuses. Yep. You do not start off your answer as to what's the U.S. reaction to this horrid thing by saying, well, what didn't happen here? And he's not one of us. Turns out, and the point two, the president is, and this is something we could, you know, charge him with on many fronts, but he doesn't know the issue at all. The fact that he said, oh, he's not a U.S. citizen. Is that right? Turns to ask the journalist that he's always, you know, saying fake are news. Dumb and hateful. And they have to fill him in. Oh, he's actually a U.S. permanent resident. The president goes, oh, okay, well. So he doesn't get the issues, despite probably hearing about this in his daily, you know, iPad briefing for a week now. And three is he really presents a false choice. And I think in really, like, subhuman terms, puts a price tag on whether or not, you know, on Khashoggi's life by comparing it to the arms deal. There are not $110 billion of current arms deals between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in the works. That is what President Obama and the Saudis had agreed to. And most of that's done at this point. You know, when Trump keeps talking about this deal, that 110 figure was announced numerous times by the administration when Trump went to Saudi Arabia. But as is often the case, and Republicans and Democratic presidents alike do this, they fold in, let's say, all the deals that were done over a decade or something like that, and they say that's the amount of our trade. It really makes everyone feel good and makes the relationship seem very important. There's only about $15 billion of deals with Saudi Arabia on the table right now. It's for a THAAD missile system. So that's a more appropriate number if you wanted to even cite, you know, the kind of economic consequences the U.S. consequences, if you want to call it that, the amount of money we might not make if we didn't do business with, you know, a regime that seems to have done something horrific. That is upsetting. And I think, you know, I was reading a Brookings piece today making, I thought, a very clear argument saying, look, you that money, that $15 billion or the monthly or daily resupplies that we do for the Turkish or the Saudi Air Force funding the war in Yemen, all of that is places we should turn to for leverage. Far from being like an untouchable business or, you know, economic benefit to the U.S. that we couldn't possibly interrupt for some nagging human rights issue, that's definitely where we should be, you know, we should be hanging over them. And I've been heartened to see Republican and Democratic senators expressing outrage here. People like Lindsey Graham, you know, also the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Corker, and a bunch of Democrats saying, look, if this is true, we've got to question this U.S.-Saudi relationship. The question really is going to be, Trump would, I think, veto any sort of Senate bill that would restrict arms sales. And so is there a veto-proof majority? And would Republicans in particular be willing to, you know, overturn a Republican Trump veto, you know, in defense of human rights causes? In this environment, I'm not too,
no.
You know, I don't think that's going to happen. So, you know, it's kind of scant hope, really, when you even hear senators using these words. It's refreshing, I suppose, but we're in a climate where the president, and I would say many presidents, Democratic and Republican before him, are just unwilling to rethink this relationship. And it's particularly galling, I think, to see President Trump so comfortable, you know, putting a price tag on human rights issues like
this. And the question is, you know, the next person who might be willing to stick their neck out, you know, for this country, because the guy who was doing, some contacts for different folks, you're going to think twice before you do anything with us, because hey, who's got your back? Not this administration.
Yeah, it's also, you know, just tough as someone who sits through briefings pretty regularly on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which is in no small part fueled by the Saudi Arabian military and the militaries of its allies, which are incredibly indiscriminate in the way they conduct that war, that, you know, you see, you know, elites and members of Congress getting up in arms over one journalist perhaps being killed, when the sort of sum total of the atrocities in Yemen haven't prompted really any sort of hand-wringing over that. I mean, yes, the Congress has voted and, you know, narrowly voted down efforts to condemn the Saudis on that. But, you know, it does sort of show more double standards there. And it shows you what it takes to get the attention of people. It's nice when journalists can raise an issue like this, but we do seem to ignore a lot of other atrocities and zoom in on certain ones.
You're absolutely right. Luke, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
As always, our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News, chief foreign correspondent for the UN there for Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.